everybody. I'm Jane, and I was asked to talk about the G8 and global apartheid, and basically how the G8 sets up a global system of inequality, basically between rich and poor states, but also between the rich and poor within those states, and particularly looking at how global apartheid is maintained by the use of borders, and looking at migrant struggles through that perspective. So, slide. The first thing that I think we should talk about is what is global apartheid. So this is a definition that I just grabbed from an article in The Nation. It's maybe not the best definition we can find, but it's a decent one. So in case everyone can't see that, it defines global apartheid as an international system of minority rule whose attributes include differential access to basic human rights, wealth and power structured by race and place, structural racism embedded in global economic processes, political institutions, and cultural assumptions, and the international practice of double standards that assume inferior rights to be appropriate for certain others defined by location, origin, race, or gender. And I think using this definition, the definition of global apartheid, is really important because I think it adds some nuances that terms that are maybe more commonly used, like economic globalization or capitalist globalization or corporate globalization or neoliberalism, I think they miss some of the really important dynamics that occur when we talk about globalization, and namely that the system set up by neoliberalism is one that is structured by race and by place specifically, among other things, but particularly those two things, and for the purposes of the presentation, that's what I will be focusing on. I'm also just going to note that because I'm focusing on migration as an issue, I'm particularly going to be talking about between states, but I think it is important to note that these same systems of inequality are replicated within states, including within G8 states. So I'm just going to preface everything that I say with that. So basically, I think the G8, everyone knows, Alex kind of gave us a little precursor to this, is one of the major bodies. Those eight states are the major people who are promoting the system of global apartheid, the Euro-American states. And even though, you know, Japan is included and now we have Obama, it's still the primary way that a system of white Western minority rule is established across the globe. And this is done primarily through the G8's control over a bunch of institutions, but primarily the World Bank, the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. So the G8 controls a little bit over 40% of the vote in the IMF and the World Bank, because voting in both of those institutions is done on a $1 one vote basis. And they also control the Quad in the WTO, which I think is Japan, Canada, the US, and the EU, if I'm not mistaken. So these institutions have been used by the G8 to control southern nations, basically. The IMF in particular, using debt as a mechanism, forcing southern countries to accept structural adjustment programs in order to pay off their debt. So these structural adjustment programs basically force southern countries to adopt neoliberal reforms, so things like cutting government provided services, the removal of protectionist policies that protected their industries, privatization, trade liberalization, etc. And then the other way that it's done is through the use of trade rules, which have basically forced southern producers to focus on export-oriented, like cash crops and primary products, as opposed to things that are more value-added. So these are basically all really bad for the South and really good for northern transnationals trying to exploit the South, if we want to put it in a really simple, maybe too simple way. But essentially, that's what they're there for. And that's creating a really clear economic divide. And that economic divide is racialized if we're looking at the race dynamic between the North and the South. And I'd also like to suggest that those were the economic ways the G8 reinforces the divide, but there's also other ways that reinforce this divide. For example, G8 countries are the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases. they are unwilling to do anything about this. As we have seen in Copenhagen, G8 countries aren't really willing to reduce their own emissions, nor are they particularly willing to provide any money for southern nations to develop without producing emissions. And it's southern countries, not northern countries, that are going to bear the brunt of climate change. So Megan, can you? So that's a picture of Tuvalu, which is maybe the poster child of a country that's going to be really negatively impacted by climate change. It's a really low-lying nation, so it is going to be one of the first that gets destroyed with sea level rises. So I just think that's like a pretty dramatic photo. And that's the reality of climate change for some countries in the global south. Apart from climate change, I mean, we know the G8 countries are involved in war and occupation. HIV/AIDS is something else that's really heavily structured, like north and south, and that certainly the response to has been heavily influenced by the G8's neoliberal policies and trade rules. And I could go on, but I'm not going to. But the point is that there's a global inequality that exists. I'm going to call this global apartheid, and that's because it sets up a really clear divide between the rich and the poor and discriminates against people based on their race and their place. So I'm hoping, based on what I just said, it's pretty obvious why people migrate from the south to the north. They basically have way fewer rights, way less economic opportunity, they're having violence inflicted upon them, etc. So the G8 countries are essentially systematically structuring the world so that people are going to want to leave the places where they have no power and go to places where there's the potential for them to have more power, more economic, I don't know what, economic access, social access, etc. So from this perspective, migration is very much, from south to north, is very much a survival mechanism. And I think that's important to remember, not only for the people who migrate, but also for the people who are left back at home when people migrate. Remittance payments, which is the money that people send home when they migrate. Megan, can you hit the next slide? Make up like a huge... Oh.
It's okay.
Make up a huge portion of many southern countries' GDPs. I know Ecuador, that's one country that I'm familiar with. Remittance payments are actually second only to oil in making up the country's GDP. So remittance payments, it's like oil is the first thing that makes up their GDP. Remittance payments that people are sending home, mainly from the US, is the second biggest contributor to their GDP. So remittance payments are like huge. And this is just a graph I found of aid versus remittance payments to Haiti. So clearly remittance payments far outstrip aid in terms of sending money to southern countries. All right, so given this, I'm basically saying global apartheid is a root cause of migration from the south to the north. So why is it that the G8 is so intent on enforcing these borders? And basically, this is kind of the crux of my argument, and that's that the maintenance of a system of global apartheid in which the G8 countries have control can only be maintained when there are strong borders, and that this is one of the reasons that we have seen the strengthening of borders in the neoliberal years. Asif mentioned at the beginning that it's kind of often like considered a curiosity that neoliberalism like opens borders to capital, but doesn't open borders to people at all. In fact, it's doing the opposite. And there's a really like clear reason why it is that G8 countries are not wanting migrants from the south, even though they're fundamentally responsible for creating the conditions in which they're forced to migrate. So Megan, if you want to hit the next slide. So these are just some pictures from the Mexican-US border. They've clearly been fortifying those borders recently and continue to do so. Across the G8 countries, we've seen strengthening of borders. In Ontario last year, we had the first kind of US-style crackdowns on workplaces in the Mississauga area, and so workplaces where there were primarily migrant workers working, so that's like another example. Canada, under our current immigration minister, is probably at an all-time low when it comes to immigration, not that it's ever been that great. And so why is this the case? Why are G8 countries so intent on maintaining borders? if borders were left open, people from the South would come to the North within the current neoliberal system. And this would fundamentally disrupt the ability of the G8 powers to hold power. And I think that probably the easiest way of looking at this is in terms of labor. Because open borders would fundamentally disrupt the cheap labor system that has evolved under neoliberalism, because certainly a key part of the neoliberal regime has been the maintenance of cheap labor supplies in the global South, and that's one of the major things. That's when we talk about a race to the bottom and corporations moving like basically as quickly as they can to whatever countries have the cheapest wages, the lowest environmental standards, etc. That's what we're talking about. If borders were open, people wouldn't stay in countries where they were being paid the lowest wages in the world. If they had a choice, they would leave. And then where would these corporations go? So basically, if people were allowed to migrate, it would force wages to equalize around the world. And I think that's a pretty important point, because often migrants are blamed for stealing jobs when they're coming to Canada. But if we look a little bit more critically at this, it's precisely because of the existence of borders that we're having a situation where other countries have really low wages, and that we've actually seen, like under globalization and neoliberalism, the outsourcing of certainly manufacturing jobs from the global north to the global south. So in some ways, there's like a totally opposite dynamic going on there. Megan, do you want to have the next slide? Oh, I missed that one. That's a cute cartoon. And then Canada's temporary foreign worker program is another really excellent example of how the existence of borders is maintaining low wage systems here in a G8 country. Basically, this program allows people to migrate for short periods of time, often seasonally, either as live-in caregivers or seasonal agricultural workers or as construction workers. And they are allowed basically to come here to work, but they're often tied to their employer. So if they quit their job, they're not allowed to stay, which often leaves them open for all kinds of abuse and exploitation. They are very, very rarely actually allowed to migrate to Canada. They're often paid lower wages than Canadians would accept. And obviously, this dynamic is only allowed to exist because of the existence of borders. So in some ways, I think we really need to look, when we're looking at migrants and their struggles, we really need to look, especially those who are here illegally and they're not sanctioned by the state, as kind of like, I don't know, as really, they're coming here to survive, but they're also really resisting a really unjust system in a really fundamental way. And I mean, legally, there's only two ways migrants can come here, and that's basically by having enough money that they can prove that they will contribute to Canada's economy, or fulfilling some kind of particular labor market need. Or if they have family ties here, but I'm going to leave that out for now. Or as refugees. And the definition of refugee that Canada, as well as other G8 countries, adopts is that of the UN and what they define, and that's they define a refugee as follows. It's a person who, owing to a well-founded fear of being persecuted on account of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion, is outside the country of their nationality and is unable to, or owing to such fear, is unwilling to, avail him or herself to the protection of that country. So basically, this excludes a whole lot of people. It excludes what we might call economic migrants, who migrate here for economic reasons. It would exclude environmental refugees or climate refugees. But if we're looking at the whole global system as one of global apartheid that does systematically discriminate on the basis of race, I think we can see how we might want this definition of a refugee to be broadened considerably, and how people who are here illegally are not like bad people who are disobeying laws. They're people who have been fundamentally discriminated against, just like refugees that are considered more legit. And finally, I just wanted to kind of go back to where Alex was going and talk about development and the G8's like poverty alleviation agenda, so-called, because the development ministers are who are meeting here in Halifax. And I think, I mean, there's lots of reasons to be really suspect of the G8's commitment to fighting poverty, and obviously fighting poverty in any substantial way would require them to stop exploiting the global south, which they're not about to do under neoliberalism. But I'm going to go back to that graph that I showed at the beginning about Haiti. Oh, other way. That one. Because I wanted to like take a more critical look at this for a second. So remittance payments far outstrip aid. So if we're talking Haiti and we're saying Haiti just had an earthquake, say, for example, what would be the best way to help Haiti if we were serious about poverty alleviation?
Forgive their debt?
Well, that would be one really good way of helping Haiti. And this is like, I'm just going to point out, like, what I'm going to suggest is a totally realistic solution. It's not, I'm not saying get rid of all borders, even though that's what I would really like to do. But the best way, if the G8, or a really good way, maybe apart from forgiving debt, would be to allow all the Haitians who are here in Canada currently without status, give them status. There's lots of them. And they're sending lots of money home. And if they were allowed to live here as citizens, they would probably be able to make more money and would probably be able to send more money home. They'd be in a much less precarious situation. So that would be a really easy way of helping Haiti. Now, the G8's not really serious about helping Haiti, in my opinion, anyways, which is why that isn't even considered as an option. And I think it's relevant to note that you can even find, before coming here, I was like just doing a quick Google search, and I found this guy on this website called reason.com, free minds and free markets. So not exactly like a radical thinker by any means. And he's an economist called Lant Pritchett. And he was making the case that neoclassical economics, which he wholeheartedly subscribes to, and free trade can actually not function in any kind of way that their models suggest while there are borders. Precisely because of what I'm saying, it creates this huge wage differential, and in his mind, that's like causing an imperfection in his like imaginary neoclassical mind. So that's not even like a radical solution by any means, but it's certainly not one. Naturalizing, is that the right word? But basically, if Haitian people were here without status, giving them status, that's not something that would even be considered by the Canadian government. Or allowing the Haitian people who are here to sponsor people from Haiti to come over. I'm sure that's not being considered either. But I just think it's an important thing to keep in mind. And just finally, this is like a little bit off topic, but on the subject of aid, I just came across this graph, so couldn't resist throwing it in. Megan? The other direction. So I just wanted to point out the top three. You actually can't see the third one, but the top three recipients of Canadian aid, 2008 to 2009. Number one is Afghanistan, number two is Haiti, and number three is Iraq. So I think we can see the real priorities of the Canadian government in giving aid really quite clearly from that depiction. So that's really all I have to say. So yeah, thanks. Thank you.